Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Paul Walker, and I'm here on behalf of Lindy Baggy, Laszlo Baggy, and Baggy Mechanical, the appellants in this case. This case presents the extraordinary circumstance where the district court enforced an unsigned disputed settlement agreement, effectively amounting to the sanctions that ended the litigation based upon the appellant's technical non-compliance with an order directing them to retain counsel, arguably 2 or 3 days later. This result is not consistent with our court's goal of resolving disputes on their merits, not on technicalities. Fundamentally, I think it's important to first conclude that Judge Klein's orders of April 27, then confirmed later by his May 2 order, did amount to a sanctions order.
And under what rule of procedure was that order entered? 37, 11, 107?
Actually, it's not entirely clear. The order first entered by Judge Klein on April 27 was handwritten on the appellee's motion for order to show cause and for sanctions.
Is it a contempt order?
I think that's an open question, and I've argued that when a court enters some sort of an order ending sanctions that is not based upon the merits, that those cases that do arise under Rule 37 that amount to discovery sanctions, for example, ought to apply in this type of circumstance. I think a very brief review of the critical facts in the case, I think, is important. In the fall of 2011, the parties, after already having tried their substantive claims against one another to a functional draw, had remaining their respective claims for equitable accounting, for the dissolution of, or the disposition of the assets of the LLC over which they were fighting. Prior to the hearing that had been scheduled for the purpose of resolving the equitable accounting claims, the parties engaged in a settlement dialogue just prior to the hearing that had been scheduled. A lawyer who had entered an appearance in the case, but a lawyer nevertheless representing the Baggies, engaged with counsel for the appellees in a settlement dialogue. And as is very common, the parties worked through the various terms of their agreement, and with the intent to reduce that agreement to a writing that would be signed by all of the parties. At some point along the way, Mr. Edwards advised counsel for appellees that he thought that they had a deal and that they should start circulating the written documents for review and signature of the parties. It was during that process that the appellants determined that all of the terms were acceptable to them except one, and that was the dismissal of the claims that they filed against appellee's counsel in another matter that was then pending in the Boulder District Court.
Well, as I read the emails, at one point, I think it was Mr. Edwards indicated that all clients were on board.
There is an email to that effect, and I think if the court would hold the parties before they could review the written document and sign the document, then that puts lawyers and their clients in jeopardy for making any sort of representations that functionally advance settlement dialogues.
But based upon the emails, it would appear that there was ample opportunity for, and in fact, perhaps it was circulated to all those clients before Mr. Edwards wrote that email.
Certainly after the written settlement document was circulated to the appellants and they read the document, they did not agree. And this was just a matter of a few days later from the date of the email from Mr. Edwards. Otherwise, I think, I don't know how we would basically be enforcing settlement agreements on parties in circumstances where it's unclear what exactly they were agreeing upon. And that is the point of reducing agreements to writing, so that we can understand exactly what the agreement was. But back to the point of whether or not there was a settlement agreement, the purpose of the hearing was for the parties to present evidence of the sort that you suggest. What exactly did the parties read? What exactly did they have an opportunity to review? Did they review? Was Mr. Edwards incorrect about whatever his conclusion was in terms of what he thought his clients understood and agreed to? And Judge Klein's order wiped out the opportunity for the appellants to at least have the opportunity to have that hearing and present any evidence of that sort. And it's clear from his order, where he focuses upon the order entered 2 weeks earlier or so by Judge Butler, that the appellants were to retain counsel within 14 days of the April 10 order. On that basis, the court vacates its order of May 1 and hereby reinstates its order dated April 25.
There was a status requirement also on that, right?
That's correct.
Was the court notified the status of counsel?
So, to identify the timeline, April 10 was the date that the parties were to have their hearing on the merits of their equitable accounting claims. On that date, their then counsel filed a motion. Well, he didn't file a motion. He just moved orally to withdraw from the case. Judge Butler made the determination to grant that motion, and because, of course, Baggies and Baggy Mechanical LLC was unrepresented at that moment, continued the hearing, and in his oral dialogue indicated that they should move quickly to get new counsel so that the case could be moved along. Several days later, Judge Butler reduced his order to writing, and in that order included the requirement that they retain counsel within 14 days. It's actually not entirely clear whether they were to retain counsel or whether they were to have counsel enter an appearance.
So the 14-day requirement was not given directly to the clients orally at this hearing?
It's a very brief hearing on April 10th, that's correct. According to the affidavit submitted by appellants, they believed that they had 14, so after they received the written order that Judge Butler entered, they misunderstood the order. They were looking at the date that he entered the order, that was written on the order, which was some several days later, and advised their new counsel that they retained that they had to have that person enter his appearance within 14 days of the written order. That was their confusion. In fact, so that date would have been April. Their understanding was that they had until, I think, April 27 to get new counsel, because they're the way they did the 14 days. On April 25, 15 days after the April 10 order, the appellees filed their motion for order to show cause, and that motion was granted on the day that it was filed. So the appellants were not given an opportunity to be heard even on the whether sanctions should be imposed, without realizing that that order had actually entered, because it had not been filed and served, so it was not available on the system. The Baggy's new counsel entered his appearance, which was me, on April 26. At that point, the court filed and served his April 25 order on April 26, and we responded to that order with a response to the motion for order to show cause. So, in short, at most that could be said here is that the appellants misunderstood the court's order to the extent that it specifically ordered them to get counsel replacing their old counsel, and they did that within just a few days of even arguably the technical specific requirements from Judge Butler's order. And the cases that I cite in the brief JP versus district court and Nagy versus district court for the proposition that either witness preclusion or issue preclusion or any sort of order that ends the litigation or seriously precludes a party from presenting his or her case based upon some sort of sanction has to be imposed after careful consideration of, for example, the willfulness, bad faith, conduct, and flagrant dereliction of a discovery obligation, or culpable conduct that's more than inadvertence or simple negligence.
And you're asking us to analogize an order enforcing a settlement agreement to an order entering a default judgment or, you know, litigation ending order. Do you have any case law that has recognized that similarity?
I have not. I think it's a fairly unusual circumstance from the standpoint that what the court did plainly was impose that sanction of ending the litigation through the enforcement of the settlement agreement without hearing and without giving the appellants the opportunity to be heard. I see I'm down to 4 minutes. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time if I may.
Okay, please, Court Joel McGuire, appearing on behalf of Julie Wellinger, who is the personal representative of the estate of Jeffrey Wellinger. I'd like to clarify or correct a couple things that Mr. Fergrand said in his argument. This was not a settlement of just what I call the 312 case, 2009 CB312. It was also a settlement of two other cases, the fraudulent conveyance action and the WD case, as well as providing a mechanism for Laszlo Baggy to pay off the judgment that Ms. Wellinger had, or that the estate had against him.
The WB case was the legal malpractice case against you, right?
Yes, right. And the last thing he did was to provide for the dissolution and the winding up of WB Service and Control as the entity that Laszlo Baggy and Jeffrey Wellinger formed in January 2009. So this was a true global settlement. And also the settlement occurred immediately prior to two hearings in two separate cases. The settlement reached in email communications occurred late in the afternoon on August 22nd of 2010 or 11, I've forgotten, August 22nd. And at 9 o'clock a.m. the following morning, there was a hearing on the equitable claim for accounting. 3 days later, there was another hearing in the fraudulent conveyance action on our motion for attorney fees, which the court had granted for their, or she found that their counterclaims in the fraudulent conveyance action were groundless. So she awarded us attorney fees. This was a hearing on the reasonableness of those fees, and we had requested roughly $12,000 in fees and costs. So all those things were pending or right before the settlement was reached on August 22nd. Also, Mr. Fordran misspoke when he said that the April 10th hearing was on the equitable accounting claim. The April 10th hearing was on the motion to enforce the settlement. So, based on the Baggies' repeated failures to comply with discovery and prior orders, including a motion to compel discovery that was about a month or less than a month before the April 10th hearing, I think it's arguable that Judge Klein did not abuse his discretion if he decided to grant the motion to enforce as a sanction. But I don't think we need to address that for two reasons. First of all, the order that he entered, I think it was April 27th, on that he says that he granted the motion to enforce based on the reasons stated in the motion for sanctions and also for the reasons stated in the motion to enforce. The motions for sanctions itself laid out in detail why the judge should go ahead and grant the motion to enforce. So this was another, I kept on trying in different pleadings to say, look, Judge, we don't need a hearing because they haven't presented any evidence. There's no disputed issue of fact. You can rule based on the evidence in front of you. And so in referencing the motion of sanctions, we don't know what was going through Judge Klein's mind, but he could have been thinking, I'm saying the reasons stated in the motions for sanctions, and he was referring to the reasons why the motion to enforce should be granted on its merits.
Well, isn't his order a contempt order?
I filed the motion for, I can't remember what it was called, sanctions, and I assume, I don't have it right now, but I assume I referenced Rule 37.
You asked for show cause.
Show cause.
And his order says Judge Butler made it very clear that new counsel was to be retained within 14 days of the April 10th, 2012 order. On that basis, the court now vacates the order of 5-1-12 and hereby reinstates the order of 4-25-12. How are we to read this as anything other than a contempt order? And if that's right, how can we review this as an abuse of discretion?
Well, I think you can't ignore his prior order of April 27th, because in that order, sure as it was, it does say that he is granting the motion to enforce based on the motion to enforce, the reason stated in the motion to enforce. I recognize what you're saying about his subsequent order, the one that is falling on his sword. But I think that just indicates that had some part that weighed in his mind, I suppose. I mean, he wouldn't have mentioned it if it didn't play some role.
Well, he does say that. He says, you're quite right, he says that for the reasons set forth in the plaintiff's motion to show cause, but in your motion to show cause, you say the defendant should be ordered to show cause why they should not be sanctioned for their failure to comply with Judge Butler's order.
Right, that's why.
But do you cite a rule in support of that? The problem I'm having with your position is I have no idea what the judge is basing any of this on. We're kind of guessing here, aren't we?
All we can go on is what we read on the document. And
that makes it the challenge.
Yeah, and so all we know is he initially said he was granting the motion to enforce for the reason stated in the motion to enforce and the motion for sanctions.
For the motion to enforce and sanctions appeared, it sounds like contempt, as Judge Graham was saying.
Well, the motion to enforce is the motion that was filed on September 2nd of the prior year. And that was, of course, arguing that the motion to enforce should be granted because there was a settlement.
Because it was a settlement, but it changed after that. I mean,
pardon me?
The nature of this case, I don't understand.
Well, it didn't change in that it remained the same. And the only thing on the table up until April 10th, at least, was the motion to enforce. Okay. We had a hearing, and we were going to have a hearing on April 10th to decide that motion. And then we got into the problem with the Baggies terminating their counsel, Mr. Woolbrand withdrawing, and then all this other stuff. That added this other element. In other words, did Judge Klein, did the fact that the Baggies, in his mind, and I think from the documents, they did not comply with the court's order, did that weigh into his decision to grant the motion to enforce? Mr. Bornbrand says it did. I say we don't know, but we do know that the merits of the motion to enforce played a role in that decision. So we can't just set that aside and say, well, that had nothing to do with the reason why he granted the motion to enforce, because he stated that the motion to enforce was granted on its merits, and apparently the fact that they didn't comply with Judge Butler's order had some role, but what I'm saying in the brief is it doesn't matter. I'm not really trying to defend. If this was a sanction, I couldn't put up a great argument that it wasn't abuse of discretion, but I'm saying it doesn't matter. Because if you look at the record, clearly they did not present an issue with regard to whether or not a settlement had been reached. If you look at those emails, it's not just a single email we're talking about here. This started in March, the prior March. It picked up again in June, and then it got real serious around the end of July, early August. And repeatedly, Mr. Edwards said, the baggies have reviewed this. The baggies have authorized this. The baggies will do this. They will do this. It wasn't like Laszlo Baggy said this, and I haven't talked to Wendy. It was the baggies.
Well, he has apparent authority, but don't you have to have a hearing to determine the breadth and depth of his authority? As a matter of fact, the parties had a hearing scheduled. And
yes,
the hearing was to determine the facts and circumstances of the parties' agreement. That was the hearing that was vacant.
They asked for a hearing the prior fall. Judge Klein agreed, apparently, because the clerk set it for a hearing. I consistently argued that we didn't need a hearing because there were other things that came up, because they weren't filing or complying with discovery orders and stuff. And when I got a chance, I'd say, look, we don't need to do this. We can rule on the merits here. And I'm suggesting that at some point, Judge Klein took a careful look at the evidence and decided in his own mind, despite the fact that he initially said, yeah, let's have a hearing, that we don't need a hearing. Because a hearing is to decide disputed issues of fact, and there were none. The only evidence that they presented, back to your question about apparent authority, there is a presumption of authority. His authority was shown in the emails because he said, the baggies, I have reviewed this with the baggies, not Laszlo Baggy, not Baggy Mechanicals, baggies. So that is evidence of his actual authority.
Let me just hold you on that business of his authority for a moment. In a reply brief, opposing counsel says a presumption that an attorney is authorized isn't applicable where the attorney is not counsel of record. Now, I understand the attorney that was representing the baggies in these discussions was not counsel of record. Do you agree that that makes a difference?
I do not. And the Scholes case, which is the 10th Circuit case, it says there's a presumption that an attorney has express authority to settle unless there is evidence to the contrary in the record. Now, in that case, the attorney was counsel of record in the litigation. But I don't see that makes it. They didn't point that out. They didn't say counsel of record in the litigation only. Because let's say you have a corporation, you have a general counsel, right? General counsel can enter into a settlement agreement bind his client, even though the litigation counsel that the general counsel may have hired is clueless or is not involved in that process.
Okay, but the quote from Scholes that you just recited said, unless there is evidence in the record to the contrary or something, you know,
right,
to reflect this. Well, don't we have such evidence in this case in the form of the affidavit from Wendy Baggy?
Well, that affidavit, Your Honor, was filed in the post-trial motion. Prior to that time, the only evidence, if you want to call it that, they submitted was Paul Gordon's email sent 3 days after the settlement was reached and a day after counsel, Mr. Woolrad, myself, and Mr. Edwards had agreed on every term in the formal document. What he said in that email on August 25th was, she does not agree. He didn't say, she did not agree, she never agreed to this. He says, she did not agree. That's buyer's remorse, okay? And they did not, there's no evidence ever that Edwards and Woolrad that Wendy did not tell them not to settle. There's no evidence from Laszlo that he did not agree to the terms or that he did not discuss the terms with Wendy. There's no evidence from Wendy that she did not discuss the terms with Laszlo. All we have is a little point in time, 3 days after the settlement, where Mr. Gordon says she does not agree to the settlement. That is not evidence that there was no actual authority for Mr. Edwards or Mr. Woolrad to enter into the agreement 3 days earlier. And by the way, Mr. Woolrad was counsel of record in all the cases except for the WB case. And I don't think, we don't need Mr. Gordon to participate in the negotiations. There's no requirement that the baggies, that all of their agents have to participate in the negotiation. They appointed Mr. Edwards to negotiate for them. That's undisputed. And Mr. Woolrad was along for the ride because he was getting copied on all the emails. He knew exactly what was going on. Their agent entered into the agreement. There's a presumption that he has actual authority. They have not provided any evidence to the contrary. Therefore, they agree by law. And they apparently decided to, they made a conscious decision to leave Paul Gordon out of it, because his email says, "I have not been involved in negotiations, so I can't comment on this." This is when he's reporting what Wendy supposedly told him, which, by the way, is double hearsay. Wendy told Gordon, Gordon told Edwards. So I don't even think that would be admissible evidence.
Wouldn't you have the opportunity to prove that up if we remanded because the order was defective?
Well, if you rule that the order is defective and you remanded, then there would be a hearing on that. But what I'm saying is litigants have to put it on the table when it's the time to do so. They had an opportunity. The law is clear that you can't come in a post-trial proceeding and say, "Oh, by the way, here's some evidence." Now, if it's newly discovered evidence, that's entirely different. But this wasn't newly discovered evidence. This was something that was in this Wendy Baggy's mind back in August of the prior year. And you can't just come in later, because that wastes resources. If you want the judge to rule, have them rule on what's in the record. That's the way it is. And they lost their opportunity. And I think it's very curious that of all the participants, Wilram, Edwards, Laszlo, and Wendy, only Wendy's the one that comes up and said, "I never authorized that." If Mr. Wilram and Mr. Edwards hadn't been authorized, couldn't they have said, file an affidavit and say, "Geez, I was mistaken, I misinterpreted something that Laszlo told me, or Laszlo told me that Wendy agreed"? There's none of that. Only Wendy's, which is double hearsay and it's not admissible. And my time's up. Thank you.
First, I did misspeak when I said that the hearing on April 10 was for the purpose of, the incorrect purpose of, concede to Mr. Lawrence's point on that. If the Judge Klein order concerned repeated discovery violations, then I think that he needed to address that. It's not in there, we're guessing or speculating, and I think that's improper. Judge Graham, I think your point, and I guess I didn't pick up on this nuance, is that because the court found that the appellants violated an earlier order of court, then it has to be considered under the construct of contempt. And in that circumstance, the alleged contemnor has an opportunity to be heard, and I think that's correct. And therefore, perhaps we're not looking at just reviewing the Klein order as abusive standard, as abusive discretion standard. The Scholes and the Thomas case cited by Appellees that concerned enforcing a judgment against a party didn't arise in the context of a settlement agreement. Those were representations made by counsel of record to the court that the case should be settled and that lawyer had authority to settle. That's not what happened here. There were never representations made by Mr. Edwards to the court, by Mr. Wolrath to the court. That didn't happen.
Could you address the issue of whether the affidavit from Wendy Baggy was untimely because it was first raised in a post-trial motion?
Well, I think the irony of that position is that they were foreclosed from having the opportunity to put evidence into the record when Judge Klein entered his sanctions order. I think to insist that, well, now you're not permitted to put any evidence into the record is sort of compounding the problem in terms of the lack of process here that was afforded to the appellants.
Is there enough evidence in this record for us to conclude that a settlement was reached and the court, whatever the final ruling was, that the court was looking at those facts and saying the parties did reach a settlement?
I don't think so. I think even the proffered evidence that Appellees made, which was emails, is not proper evidence anyway. There was no affidavit indicating the you know, the source of these emails or that they were true and accurate. You know, we were trying to insist upon litigation and judgment here, and not just of the cases that were before Judge Klein, but a separate malpractice and abuse of process case that was pending elsewhere. So we're going to resolve all of those cases on an email string, without more, without insisting that we have testimony from Mr. Edwards or Mr. Woolrath or any of the speculation that we've heard and that were presented to in the motion to enforce. So I don't believe that there's a sufficient evidence to conclude that a settlement agreement was reached. I think there's just more than enough question, and there's no evidence in front of the judge at that time. And that's all I have. Thank you for this information.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.